Coming up on Tech News Weekly, what do you do when Google thinks you're dead? Also, what does Tom Merritt do to cut the cord? What will a small wireless ISP do now that net neutrality regulations are gone? And what games will Sam Moskovich from Ars Technica play to celebrate the end of 2017, the year of reckoning? All that and more coming up next on Tech News Weekly.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Tech News Weekly is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Tech News Weekly, episode 11, recorded Thursday, December 21st, 2017.
This episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by GoToWebinar, a trusted webinar platform with over 55,000 customers who have hosted over 2.7 million interactive web events to connect with their audiences. For more, visit GoToWebinar.com/podcast. Welcome to Tech News Weekly. This is a show where every week we talk to people in tech making and breaking the news. I'm Megan Maroney.
And I am Jason Howell. Sometimes we talk to people who are living, even if Google doesn't want to believe it.
We do. So who among us has not wanted Google to remove unflattering photographs or information about us that pop up when someone Googles our name? When someone Googled our next guest's name, the information that came up was not only unflattering, it was extremely unflattering. In fact, Google said she was dead. Rachel Abrams is a business reporter for the New York Times. Welcome to the show, Rachel.
Hi there. Thank you for having me.
So because this was fixed presumably because you work for the New York Times and you wrote an article about it. But before it was fixed, tell us what happened when someone Googled the name Rachel Abrams.
Sure. So first, my dad alerted me that basically it said that I was dead on a knowledge graph panel, which is the box of information that pops up to the right of search results when you Google commonly searched terms like Macy's or Brad Pitt. And so this box had biographical details for somebody else with my picture on it. So I get this text message from my dad saying, you know, you died in 2013. He was reasonably sure I had not died. And I sort of ignored it because it seemed very inconsequential. Anybody that knew me, anyone that knows me would not have been confused. But then I met with a journalism student who I'd only seen once. She came to the New York Times to do coffee and sort of follow up. And she said, you know, I was sort of alarmed to read that you had passed away. And so I thought, well, you know, maybe this is an error worth fixing. And so that sort of started my quest to try to tell somebody at Google that I was in fact alive and that this was wrong.
So it was a little bit of like a hero's journey. Tell us about what steps you took to try to get this off the, or just get your photo off the knowledge graph.
So my photo comes from the New York Times website. It's my official New York Times headshot that appears on my bio page, which everybody here has. And so I caught, because it was sort of a work product issue, I contacted somebody on the corporate communications team at Google. And I told them, explain my situation. I said, you know, is there anything I can do to fix this? I think I also used one of Google's many, many feedback options that they offer online. I can't remember which one came first, to be honest, but I think it was, I don't have the story in front of me, but I used some feedback option. Google has a bunch depending on what product you need and what issue you have. So the spokeswoman basically pointed me toward a publicly available website to suggest a change to this knowledge graph panel. So that's the first time I even find out what this box is. It's called a knowledge graph panel. And she basically just says I should go through these steps. And so the first step to correcting or suggesting a change to a knowledge graph panel is that Google has to recognize you as an authorized, I think it was, they recognize you as an official expert or authority on a topic. I can't remember the exact quote, but it's some formal procedure. And so I thought, okay, that's fine. That seems annoying, but I am an expert on what I look like and who I am, whether I'm dead. So I tried to use some of these steps, and it becomes very clear that none of these steps seem appropriate. And not only that, but I don't even understand what a couple of these things mean. And I'm not a tech reporter. I'm a business reporter. But I'm also just personally kind of a not techie person. So I thought, well, maybe everyone knows this and knows what this means and what to do. But I emailed the spokeswoman again. I get no response. I try to make these steps work. I tell the little bot at the bottom of the steps that knows her advice was not helpful, which prompts me to fill out another feedback form. So I fill out another feedback form. I hit submit, and this bot, whose name is Katie, I guess, which is like the only human that's really made, this is the closest thing to a human that average people get when they're trying to contact Google for help. So Katie says, thank you. And, there's no like pledge to do anything. So I was thinking, okay, so, I really am running out of ideas. So I decided to call the Googleplex, which is the name of Google's headquarters. And I call the Googleplex, and I get an automated message, and they very quickly, they'll tell you, we don't have support here, because I'm sure that a bajillion people call the Googleplex with problems, like tech problems on various Google products. So so I call, and the recording sort of insists, like, I'm exaggerating a little bit, but it's essentially like, are you sure you want to stay on the phone? We really can't help you, and it's a really busy day today at the Googleplex, and there's plenty of information online, and if you stay on, the bright side for all of this is that it says that if you don't enjoy the whole music, you can browse Google's music selection, which is nice, I guess. At least they offer you something. So I hold, and I finally get to a human after about 20 minutes. And at the end of 20 minutes, the person that comes on the phone is sort of, I think she was like a, I don't even know what she did. She was probably somebody that like would direct my call to another part of Google. And she was like, oh, let me see, you know, if I can help you or figure out where you should go. So she basically puts me on hold. Well, she essentially Googles my problem and pulls up this page. She said, well, I found this page online. I said, okay, please direct me to what you're looking at, since it's just online. Let me look at it while I'm talking to you in case I have any questions. And the page is essentially part of Google's online help forum for people, where people, users can ask questions and get them answered, not even necessarily by Google, but by people that might know the answer. And sometimes someone at Google will endorse the answer. So what I'm saying is, she's pointing me toward a publicly available forum where the people, members of the public, are asking and answering questions as far as I can tell. And so somebody in the forums had a problem, a similar problem with their knowledge graph card, not saying that they're dead, but it's just stuff that was wrong. And she basically is reading off this card and saying, well, your problem can take 3 weeks or 3 months. And your best the best thing you could do is to submit feedback over and over and over again from multiple times. Even the woman on the phone very helpfully told me try multiple times a day. But on this site, it says try multiple times from different IP addresses. Try to get your friends to help if possible. And I basically surmise that this will help push my request to the top of Google's to-do pile, or it will do absolutely nothing. There's no way to know. And I just sort of thanked her. And the last step I took was to email Google's CEO to ask what people should do. And at the same time as I do that, I basically go back to the spokeswoman and say, you know, I'm doing a story on this, and here are my questions, and do you have any comment? Which is something you have to do to be fair in any story, but something that I realized might also push them to fix it. That's not why that I asked them, but I realized that that would be a potential consequence of me asking them, which again is an avenue to fix an issue that the average users won't have. And sure enough, within hours, it was changed.
Yeah, I mean, I just did the Google search right now, and I do get the knowledge graph report, or the little box on the side. Your photo is no longer attached there. However, the top search result is your name at the New York Times. Interesting how they do selection on one, and you know, and say this is the topmost obviously referenced person versus the search results being something completely different. What did you learn about kind of the machinations of the knowledge graph in this whole process, other than that it's really hard to change anything that happens to appear there?
So the knowledge graph, I can't pretend like I really know a whole lot about it, but the knowledge graph is it pulls from a lot of different sources from the internet in terms of where it gets this information. A lot of times the information comes from Wikipedia. I don't have a Wikipedia page, but the other more famous Rachel Abrams does have a Wikipedia page, which is where all those biographical details came from. The sprinter named Rachel Abrams from the Northern Mariana Islands, she also has a Wikipedia page, which is one of the reasons why smart speakers might identify those two people more quickly when you ask questions like, who is Rachel Abrams? Because Wikipedia is one of the more commonly sourced, one of the places where the box gets information most commonly, from what I can tell. But if you have an official webpage, there are other places around the internet where Google could get information. And so what I think happened, and I never did not get an answer from Google about this, but just based on talking to people that know this world and could make an educated guess, what I think might have happened was that Google basically scanned the Wikipedia page of this the Rachel Abrams, the other writer whose details were in that box. They saw that the only photo on her Wikipedia page was a very small, grainy photo that was probably too low quality for what Google's algorithm thinks is appropriate for that box. And so Google, the mechanism probably, in my best guess, is that it scanned the rest of the internet for a New York Rachel Abrams writer. I mean, I really don't know what else was searched for, but they probably looked for basically another photo that would match this person. And because I am also a New York writer, Rachel Abrams, that might have been why Google plucked my photo from the New York Times webpage.
Yeah, what's interesting to me now is, as you were talking, I went over to the images tab, and the photo that used to be attached to it, your photo that used to be part of that knowledge graph little box, is the very first result that you get on the Google images search if you just do a straight search for Rachel Abrams.
Really? So
then it kind of seems like, okay, well, the fallback, I guess, is not the Wikipedia image. It's whatever comes first. There it is, right up at the top left corner.
Yeah, so those, and I recognize the other Rachel Abrams is also in that top section. And I also see a photo from a third Rachel Abrams author. I'm also not the Rachel Abrams that wrote The Multi-Orgasmic Woman, which is the woman on the top. So there's a lot of us, and I've been mistaken for a lot of them, but I am the famous Rachel Abrams out there.
You are you.
Well, the reason why I was so fascinated with this is it is part of the knowledge graph. And that is Google sort of implicitly saying, here's the truth. Here's the answer you're looking for. And it's clearly not the truth. And also, you point out in your article, this is what Google's smart speaker uses to answer questions as well.
Yes. So Google and Alexa, it seemed like, rely heavily on these cards to answer questions. So they probably pull from these cards, meaning that if the cards have information that isn't correct, the speakers will repeat them, which just means that whatever error there is going to be duplicated in another context. And I should point out, because I point this out in the story, and I just want to make it clear, this is sort of a lighthearted issue for me. But one of the reasons we chose to do this story is because for many, many people, misinformation about themselves on the internet is very damaging. We live in an age of revenge porn and cyberbullying, and when things go wrong online, it can really affect your job prospects and your reputation, and that's why there are entire companies that you can pay to help try to fix misleading information, or even just information you don't like about yourself online, is because it is a serious issue. That's not the case in this particular circumstance, but that certainly is the case for a lot of people. So I just want to make it clear that, like, the fact that this was very difficult for me as a member of the media, somebody for whom you would think that Google would want to change or have an incentive, more of an incentive, then I can't imagine how hard it is for other people that are dealing with problems about information about themselves online.
Yeah.
And so part of your reporting, you spoke to the CEO of Reputation Defender, which is a service that does this. And, you know, I always feel like did you feel like that what they can do actually works? I mean, I know in the past some people have used them, and then if you find, you know, if someone's trying to target you online and ruin your search results on purpose, if they learn that you're using a service like, you know, Reputation Defender, you can get in trouble for that too.
I am not in a position to comment on how effective their services are. I just basically talk to them about what the options are for people looking to correct information about themselves online. What I thought was really interesting, though, about what they said I could do was that essentially my only real option for correcting information that was out there, in this case a photo, was by putting more information about myself onto the internet. Like that is the best option. It's not fixing what's already there. It's creating new information that can hopefully shove the bad information out of the way if your information somehow becomes more popular. Or I don't know how this works. I think a lot of people who aren't computer or very tech savvy people might also not really quite understand how this works. But one of the options he said that I could use was essentially I could create an entirely new web page for myself and hope that one day I basically become more famous than the other Rachel Abrams so that I would get a knowledge graph card and then mine could shove hers out of the way when people search for Rachel Abrams. And this just seemed like a really unfair strategy to both her and to me. Because why is the solution to fix something that's wrong about myself to put more of myself onto the internet? Mm-hmm. And also just to be fair, just to be fair to Google, because there are a lot of people working really, really hard on a very complicated issue at a company that affects so many people and has to deal with so much information. But, they get so many requests every day to fix stuff about knowledge graph panels or search results. And as Rich Matta from Reputation Defender pointed out, you have to assume that a lot of those requests might be inaccurate or misleading in and of themselves, or at the very least outside the scope of what Google is willing to do. Google, if the information about you appears on another website and Google is just surfacing it, then oftentimes Google is not going to think that that's Google's problem unless there's something illegal going on, in which case you can submit a different kind of request. You can submit a legal request to Google, and there you have other mechanisms or other levers to pull to fix stuff. There's just simply too many requests coming at them for them to be able to handle this in a really as quick as many people like myself might like.
And of course, there are other corporations trying to, there's a corporate fight basically between, you know, Apple and Google and Amazon, especially with smart speakers. And so I asked my Echo Dot if you were dead, and I took a video, and clearly someone at Amazon really wants to know that they know that there are many Rachel Abrams. So Alex, can we
Echo, is Rachel Abrams dead?
The New York Times reporter Rachel Abrams is still alive, as is the sprinter from the Northern Mariana Islands. The other Rachel Abrams, who was an artist and writer, died in 2013.
Well done, Echo.
That is incredible. I'm so glad you pointed that out to me. That's really funny.
Well, Rachel Abrams, the one that's still alive, thank you so much for joining us. Rachel Abrams is a business reporter at the New York Times, and she is Rachel Abrams NY on Twitter. That's your handle, right? Not someone else's?
Yes.
Right. Take
care.
Thank you, Rachel.
It was a pleasure. All right, Brian, we have an email. Brian wrote in about our discussion a few weeks ago about delivery robot congestion on sidewalks. You may remember that discussion. Brian says, why are corporations complaining about getting limited use of a public space intended for pedestrian use? San Francisco would otherwise be well within its right to refuse commercial access to sidewalks. No one would be debating whether commercial or personal vehicles should be allowed to drive on the sidewalk, nor is there anyone trying to reverse state or city laws and regulations limiting skateboard use on pedestrian pathways, which, from what I gather, is actually prohibited in San Francisco. So companies should be thanking the city for letting them have any use of delivery machines on sidewalks. It's a really good point as far as personal injury is concerned. I don't know how fast these things are moving or how heavy they might be in transit, you know, taking somebody out. Or even if they're not fast or heavy, if they're a low enough, you know, profile, it could be very easy to trip over them and hurt yourself. However, as far as the commercial use point is concerned, there's a lot of people that use the sidewalks for commercial use, right? Delivery people, couriers, delivering documents. It's just they're walking on the sidewalks to do it. And I suppose that's the difference. Sidewalks intended for walking.
Mm-hmm.
So, good points.
Thank you. You can email us at tnw@twit.tv, and we will read them and hopefully respond or read your email on the show. And our next guest is a friend of the show, the man who created the show that became this show, author, independent tech podcaster, father to dogs, and husband to Eileen's, really just one Eileen, host of the Daily Tech News Show, Tom Merritt. Welcome.
Thank you for having me. How's it going?
It's going great. So among the
best introduction I've had in ever.
I worked very hard on it, Tom. I did. I trust it.
It shows. Okay. It paid off.
So you, of course, have a panoply of podcasts, independent podcasts, not to be confused with the Panoply Network. You host Cord Killers. That's one of them. A show telling you what to watch and where to watch it. So we brought you on this, our last show of the year, so we could talk about the state of cord cutting this year and what we might see in the future. I have an Apple TV attached to my Android TV.
What?
Am I doing it wrong?
Wait, you have it attached to the Android TV box?
I don't understand. I have an Android TV. You know, a TV. You have
an Android TV set. Yeah. Got it.
But well, then I have...
Because there is a box called Android TV also. Yeah, that's bad. I just tried to clear up the confusion there.
No.
So
I was
no,
very
you're
confused.
Not. You're doing it fine. You're doing it right. Whatever works for you. The best part about cord cutting or even just streaming video, even if you haven't cut the cord, is that you have more options than ever. To do it. The boxes are getting better. 4K is de rigueur now on these boxes. Not all of them have 4K. If you don't have a 4K TV, you don't have to spend the extra. But if you do, you've got those options. And there's all kinds of streaming services out there for live television as well as on demand.
When it comes to 4K content on some of these streaming services, I remember back in the day when HD first kind of, you know, burst onto the scene, you had to get very specific as far as the types of content that you would get in that high quality. Of course, we're not there anymore. Everything's in HD. Is 4K beyond that point to where, like, you could safely say the majority of the stuff that you find on these streaming services, if you have a 4K TV, there's plenty of content to watch on it?
The difference now is with 4K TV, you have to be very specific about what kind of content you want to find.
Right.
It's pretty much exactly in the same place that you're talking about. You've got a decent selection on Netflix, particularly of stuff that they have made, with the weird exception of some of the Marvel stuff. You've got some great stuff on Amazon, again, especially with their originals. And you've got a few other services. YouTube has actually had 4K video the longest of all of them. So that can be, if you just want to put some 4K up to try it out, that can be one of your better streaming services there. But yes, the options are coming more and more stores are supporting selling a 4K version as they work out the deals with the studios on what the prices should be. Apple very famously offered if studios were going to go on board, and most of them have, they will automatically upgrade your HD copies to 4K if you're watching them on an Apple TV 4K.
So my Android TV, the actual TV, not the box, is a 4K TV, and I have the Apple TV, the new 4K Apple TV. If I want to watch Netflix in 4K, do I then have to pay extra for the 4K streaming Netflix service?
Yeah, now you may already have it. It depends on how many streams you wanted to have simultaneously, because as you pay for higher levels, you not only go from standard def to high def to 4K, you also go to multiple streams. So you might want to check before you go spend the extra money. But yeah, not every package from Netflix streaming comes with the 4K.
So Hulu Live, that came out this year, and YouTube TV also has live TV. Is there any reason to still have cable?
I mean, yes, if you don't have good bandwidth, you might still want to have cable. But if you've got, 25 to 50 megabits per second, which is 30%, 40% of the country, and a lot of people, especially in urban areas, have a good shot at getting something like that, especially if you're in an area with fiber, I would recommend looking at some of these packages. PlayStation View is my favorite because of the combination of DVR features and the easier to use guide that they have. Sling TV is still really strong. They've added a DVR feature and they've got a different selection of channels. So sometimes maybe the channel you want, because it's Viacom, for instance, Viacom pulled their channels from Sony, might be on Sling TV. That might be a better package. Hulu Live is still very much in its infancy. I've seen more problems streaming things on Hulu personally than I've seen on the other services. And YouTube TV is expanding into more and more markets, which was its original limiting factor. Right now, the problem is you have to use your phone to control it. So it's really best for somebody who's a Chromecast user who doesn't mind using their phone as a remote. It's got a great interface on the phone, and it works on iOS as well as Android. They are coming with apps for the various platforms next year, so that will become more of an option as well. But we really are getting to the point where the first consideration will soon be channels. Which one has the channels you want? And then which one has the best price for the channels? The second consideration will then be, do I like the interface? Does it work with the setup that I have? But most of them are starting to work with most of the setups.
Now, you've obviously been tapped into the cord cutting thing for a long time now, Tom. I give you huge props for that, because you were doing the cord cutting thing well before, you know, all the cool kids were. So, you know, the rest of the mainstream. Would you say that it's mainstream now? Like, are we at the point to where the line is drawn to where it's easy enough for people to just jump in and get exactly what they're looking for?
I don't think it's quite mainstream yet, you know, just because a lot of people have cable and they're happy with it. And they're like, why would I change? Especially if they're on a discounted package. Where it becomes more mainstream is as soon as that price goes up,
yeah,
and you have to call the cable company and get them to bring the price back down. The thing that I would tell people is you have to also consider the flexibility. I not only have multiple providers to choose from, which, you know, for a lot of us, we would only have one cable TV provider to choose from in the past. But you also have the ability to cancel anytime. All of these new online services let you just cancel. You don't have to sign a year contract or anything. That might change in the future, but right now it's really easy. All of them, you can go online and cancel, and that's the end of it. And they'll even give you, you know, nice emails to let you know, okay, this is the day that your service has ended because you canceled. Let us know if you want it back. But you don't get that high pressure, guilt-inducing telephone call experience that you got with cable. That said, I don't think a lot of people have it yet, but it's growing and growing, and it's got to the point where more of these cable companies are starting to come up with their own competitors for it, because they see that it's really beginning to eat in to their services. So I'd say maybe by the end of next year, certainly within 2 years, I think it will be mainstream, especially as internet service improves and people get faster bandwidth. Mm-hmm.
So do you just get everything so you can test it and talk about it?
Yeah, I do. It's a business expense. I don't keep it. Right now, I subscribe to PlayStation View and Hulu Live. I cut my YouTube TV because I just wasn't using it, and they haven't added any features. When the apps come back, I'll probably pick that one back up again. I don't have Sling TV at the moment. I just kind of pick it up when they add something new, like when they added the DVR. And I had DirecTV Now, which launched last year, and I did not like it. It was not very good. Apparently, it got better, so I tried it again, and I'm like, okay, but it still doesn't have a DVR. So when they get more features back, I might try that out. But yeah, I have to keep jumping in and out of them. With that said, the one that I go to when I'm like, I'm not trying something, I just want to watch something, is PlayStation View.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that one is very badly named, because you don't have to have a PlayStation at all to subscribe to it.
Yeah. That's one of the things that I love about the current state of this, is that we realized a long time ago, you know, a couple of years ago, that it's a waste of money for us to pay for cable every single month. Now with these services, like you were saying, without guilt, we can just drop in and oh, this is a month where we actually want to watch a couple of football games, or oh, the Olympics, like the Olympics are coming up. We don't pay month to month until something happens where we're like, okay, now is a good time for us to pay the $40, get it for the month. We know we'll watch, and that will justify the cost. One question I have for you is about Kodi, which is a name that we see bubble up in the same conversations around cord cutting, yet it's not always a legitimate approach. I mean, there are legitimate uses. It's kind of like BitTorrent. There's legitimate uses, and then there's a lot of illegitimate uses. What's your take on Kodi, and can you even recommend it?
Brian Brushwood, my co-host on Cord Killers, and I go through the, how long has it been since we talked about Kodi? Is it time yet? Because we always get this question. We don't want to be answering it every week.
Yeah.
Because first of all, there's so many streaming boxes out there that claim to get you all of television for free. If you see that, it's probably not true.
Yeah.
What they're probably doing is selling you a cheap Android box with Kodi installed on it and a bunch of software that may or may not be legal. Don't fall for it. It's not a real service. However, there's nothing wrong with Kodi at all. Kodi is just what used to be called XBMC. It's been modified to be a streaming platform that's open source, has a lot of extensions, and it's a fantastic piece of software. So I think Kodi is great and can be used for a lot of really cool things, especially if you have your own media library. It's not quite as fully featured as Plex, but it's a little more open source. So in that world, Plex and Kodi are kind of your two sides of the street. Do you want the more polished, user-friendly version? You go with Plex. If you want to toy with it and tinker with it more, you go with Kodi. Well, you can toy and tinker with Plex too. Kodi, on the other hand, has a reputation for piracy because there are many people making extensions for Kodi that allow you to get unauthorized copies of things. And that's where it gets the bad name. And it's unfortunate for that because Kodi itself is a great piece of software.
Yeah.
And like you say, BitTorrent is a good example where BitTorrent, the company, doesn't do any piracy, even was selling videos for a while and had a hard time fighting the idea that BitTorrent was used for piracy because the BitTorrent protocol was.
Mm-hmm. So we're going to talk about net neutrality in our next interview, but I want to ask, do you think that anything is going to change drastically in the next year because of net neutrality? Anything having to do with cord cutting and the way that, you know, you watch TV? What's going to change in the media future?
It's going to be an interesting thing to watch, particularly because my guess is, and this is just a guess, we didn't have these open internet rules before 2015. From 2005 to 2015, it was an information service and we were playing under the current setup. They've rolled back a few more protections in this last rule change, but it's generally the same situation. And what we had going on then was ISPs kind of carefully taking a step to see if they could get away with it, and usually not. It was either they were blocking Vonage, for instance, in one case, and they got hammered in court over it. In Comcast's case, they were blocking BitTorrent. They were blocking torrents because they're like, hey, this is illegal. This is anti-piracy. And then the public pressure to say, yeah, but you'd have to do deep packet inspection. That's a violation of net neutrality to do it, made them back off, even though they didn't have to by the rules. My guess is we will probably see one or two efforts to maybe do some zero rating or maybe exempt a service and say, well, we're not violating net neutrality. We're just not counting the bits from our service against your data cap, which is edging on net neutrality. But I don't think we'll see any flagrant violations. I don't think we'll see any actual blocks on things like Netflix or anything like that. The worst thing that I'm expecting is interconnection agreements, because a side effect of the open internet rules was that the FCC said it would respond to complaints about internet connection agreements, which were not covered under the open internet rules. But just the fact that the FCC said they would do it stopped those disputes. And those are the disputes that aren't about net neutrality. They're about Comcast and a transit provider, a company that brings the bits from one ISP to another, that brings the bits from Netflix across the internet to Comcast over the ports. And Comcast trying to throw around their weight and say, well, you have to pay us to reach our customers now, which is sort of unprecedented. That's not the way it's worked. And that caused some problems for Netflix, particularly, to get their bits transited. They weren't being blocked. There was a lot of misinterpretation of that. But Comcast was letting the ports fill up and not doing anything about it, and saying Netflix needs to pay us more money if they want us to add more ports. That went away under the open internet guidelines. I would expect to see a couple of those battles come back.
Well, Tom, thank you so much, as always, for joining us. And if you want to support Daily Tech News, and I hear from a lot of you that do love Daily Tech News, support Tom's Patreon at dailytechnewsshow.com. It makes a great last-minute holiday gift, wouldn't you say, Tom?
For me, it... No, thank you. I'm glad I named the show exactly what it is, so it's very clear.
Thanks so much. We'll see you
soon. Thank you, Tom. Happy holidays.
Good talking to you guys. Thanks again.
Good talking to you.
Next up, Brett Glass, the founder of the world's first wireless ISP, is here to talk about last week's FCC order to end net neutrality. It might not all be doom and gloom. But first, this episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by GoToWebinar, the webinar platform that's hosted 2.7 million interactive web events with over 60 million views per year. GoToWebinar believes webinars are one of the best ways to interact with your prospects and your customers instead of business presentations or company websites that all look the same. Boring. With GoToWebinar, you can create custom email invitations, confirmations, and reminders, or let GoToWebinar handle it with automated email templates. You can display your company logo and a custom image on all webinar materials. Create and schedule pre-recorded webinars that are as interactive as live events. It's also mobile-friendly. You can schedule a webinar, edit a session, or track performance from your iOS or Android device. So if you're working over the holidays, you can do it all from your Android phone, and no one will know the difference. Just just hide in your room for a little while, then go out back and after you get your work done, and then go back to hang out with your family or friends. You can create up to 20 polls before the session or on the fly for audience interaction. You can add up to 20 questions to survey and engage participants with Q&A. Engage your audience with more than one presenter and panelist. Up to 6 presenters can share their webcams and participate face-to-face. You can broadcast a view of your desktop or a specific application. And with GoToWebinar's reporting and analytics, you're just a click away from qualified leads, metrics, and data to improve webinars. You'll have end-to-end 128-bit AES encryption, so it is secure. Rated number one in customer satisfaction. Turn your next presentation into a conversation with GoToWebinar. For more information, visit GoToWebinar.com/podcast. That's GoToWebinar.com/podcast. And we thank GoToWebinar for their support.
So last week, we invited Ernesto Falcone from the Electronic Frontier Foundation to talk a little bit about the EFF's stance on the very recently gutted net neutrality regulations that resulted from a congressional vote that split largely or exactly along party lines. We haven't had much representation on this show about kind of the other side, the flip side of that coin, namely why removing this regulation from the hands of the FCC might not be as disastrous as some are saying. We've got a little bit of flack from people who are saying, hey, let's be even keeled here, represent the other side. So Brett Glass runs a wireless ISP in Wyoming called Lariat, and he joins us to share his perspective on this issue. Thank you for joining us, Brett.
Thank you for having me, Jason.
Yeah, absolutely. It's great to have you back. You were actually on the network before, back in 2014. You were on This Week in Tech. You and Dane Jasper, who's the CEO of Sonic, debated both sides of the net neutrality debate then. Of course, a lot has changed in the past 3 years since then. What's your general take in light of these changes that happened last week?
I guess I would have to say I'm extremely optimistic. I think that the regulations were a wrong turn the way they were implemented. I've asked many people, many of my own customers and other people, have they thought that since the April of 2015 that their internet experience has improved? And universally, people have said no. The regulations didn't do anything to help. And so the question is why. We need to look at what they really did as opposed to what they were claimed to do, and reevaluate which way we're going. And that's exactly what Ajit Pai, the chairman of the FCC, is doing. And I think that's wonderful. The good news is that small internet providers like me, who had 400 pages of dense legalese dumped on us all at once when that order was issued, were really laboring under the burden of that. And it really looks like now we may have a real chance to survive, because we were struggling even to do the basic things like get investors and get bank loans before.
I mean, I understand that it's a labor, you know, it's laborious going through a lot of that information. Many people would argue that that's just kind of the price that's paid in order to protect the consumer. How did the regulations affect Lariat specifically prior to these changes? Like, what were some of the things that you had to deal with as a result of that?
Well, there was a tremendous paperwork burden. There were all sorts of hoops you had to jump through to do anything. The FCC required that if you wanted to be sure that you could make any change to your service, you had to ask it for permission. You had to ask Mother, may I? And that really hurt our ability to innovate, to do things that we wanted to do. Other problem that we had was that we lost our bank, withdrew our credit line. They said, okay, a big company can probably survive these regulations, but a small company isn't going to be able to handle all of this. We don't feel comfortable loaning you money. Our investors likewise pulled out. And so while consumers were asking for more competition, for more little ISPs like me to be available to compete with the cable company and telephone company, suddenly we were at risk of not being able to compete at all. You didn't see any new ISPs formed, and the ones that did exist that weren't big were struggling a lot. So these were some of the downsides that we saw.
So when you were on Twit in 2014, Leo asked you, do you support an open internet? And your answer was that you support it to some value of the term. Can you talk a little bit about that and if that's changed at all since we had net neutrality and then lost it again?
Well, again, the term open internet, just like the term net neutrality, is really vague. Net neutrality really is not a well-defined term. In fact, it really, I guess the best way to think of it is as a slogan to promote regulation of the internet. Because if you ask any two people what net neutrality is, you will not get the same answer from either one of from any one of them. What I see as being the right thing to do is basically to do what the consumer wants. And the consumer may want us to block things. In fact, I know that our the consumers, my users, want us to block things like malware and spyware. They want themselves at least to be able to block ads because the ads on web pages drive them crazy. They don't necessarily want it to be open to any sort of abuse. And so what we really want is, I guess the best answer is not how much it's open or how much it's closed, from our perspective, but what does the user want to be open and closed and what's going to be the best for them? And that's what I think this order leaves out. It leaves no flexibility for us to do what the user really wants. It dictates that we should have no control over our own networks and that big edge providers, you know, Google, Facebook, by default, because we can't control it, would have control over the user's screen and what they receive and what they do.
What would you say your take is on you know what we've heard a lot over the past couple of weeks at least, well, more than that, but very intensely over the past couple of weeks, the competitiveness factor, the pay-to-play ability for kind of new companies, up-and-comers, that sort of thing, to compete in light of these rules? It's going to make it much more expensive for them to do so. What's your take on that?
Actually, I think it's going to make it less expensive to do so. I guess it, first of all, it'll make it much easier for competitive ISPs like my small ISP to enter the market. We'll be able to get financing. We'll be able to get loans. We'll be able to give consumers a greater choice of ISPs. Now, if you're talking about more competition among edge providers, there's going to be an opportunity to do better with that as well. While this ruling was in effect, it was impossible for my ISP to offer a new small edge provider that wanted to compete with the big guys like Google a premium delivery service that would let them get their packets through as if they owned a huge fiber net. Google has international fiber. And the only way for them to compete until they can afford to build one of their own is to rent one. Now, while the rules were in effect, I could not give them a special priority channel was the equivalent of Google's network. Now I can. And so now I can enable those competitors to compete with the big guys and possibly do better than before.
So one of the many slurs that have been foisted upon Ajit Pai, the FCC chairman, is that he was a former Verizon lawyer. Does that frighten you?
Not at all. Ajit Pai is a telecommunications lawyer, and part of the career path, when you become a telecommunications lawyer, one of the first things you do at the beginning of your career is you go and actually practice telecommunications law. So you'll go out and work for a company like Verizon, but then you move on after a couple of years, which is exactly what he did. After working for Verizon, he went to work for another law firm, and then he went into public service, and he spent the rest of his career in public service. He wasn't wedded to Verizon just because he spent 2 years working there. And in fact, if you take a look at the previous FCC chairman, Tom Wheeler, who enacted the regulations, which were enacted in 2015, Tom Wheeler spent decades as the chairman of the NCTA, the National Cable Television Association. And then after that, as the chairman of CTIA, which is the cell phone trade association. And so certainly you would expect that Tom Wheeler, having spent decades representing that industry, might be biased in favor of it. But he wasn't, and I don't think Ajit Pai is either.
Kind of an evolution of this story, at least in the last couple of days, has been the fact that the GOP proposed a new net neutrality law called the Open Internet Preservation Act. Basically, it would ban throttling and blocking by ISPs while still allowing for paid fast lanes. What's your take on the proposed law? Is this what you expected to happen so quickly after the kind of dismissal of these net neutrality regulations?
To be honest, I didn't expect it to happen so quickly, but I'm kind of glad that it did. I mean, if you take a look at that law, it does a few things that I think are really good. It incorporates language from Michael Powell's original internet policy statement, which does provide some assurances to consumers that they're going to be able to do what they want to do on the internet. It also does another thing, which was kind of slipped in at the end, which is that it makes internet providers eligible to receive USF funds, that is funds from what's called the Universal Service Fund. That's very good because it will provide a subsidy to help get internet deployed to areas that are unserved and underserved. I think that's wonderful. As for the rest of the law, I think it could use a little bit of tuning. One of the things that it does that I'm very concerned about is that it uses a term that was in all of the different regulations at the FCC. It's called reasonable network management. It says that that's allowed, but it doesn't define exactly what that is. And that's very dangerous because the word reasonable is one of the most litigated words in the English language. And little guys like me can't afford to go to court to litigate whether or not something was reasonable. So one improvement I would really like to see in that law is to lay out, okay, do we allow zero rating, for example, or not? Do we allow paid prioritization under certain conditions? Can I give someone a priority channel if it doesn't slow anyone else down? I think that's reasonable. I'd like it to say that, and so on. I'd like it to lay out in more detail what's allowed and what's not, so that we don't have a problem with having to go to court to figure it out later.
Yeah, and kind of another part of this that jumped out to me is that it prohibits local governments from implementing their own net neutrality laws kind of on a local level. What kind of complications does that sidestep, and how do you feel about – I think I know how you feel about that, but tell us your thoughts on that.
Yes. Well, my internet service provider does business in the southern corner, the southeast corner of the state of Wyoming. We're very near the state of Colorado. So suppose we wanted to go ahead and cross the border and serve Colorado. We don't want to have to hire a separate lawyer in Colorado and have separate rate plans and a separately managed network just to accommodate differences in state laws. So it's good for consumers, too, if we have a uniform regime that basically sets the rules for the entire country. The internet doesn't have borders, and it doesn't make sense to impose any in terms of the laws.
All right. Well, Brett Glass with Lariat, we really appreciate you taking time to kind of share your side of the perspective. It's always good to get both sides of the argument, and I realize it goes much further beyond just two sides of this. It's a very heated issue. Can you understand why people are so worried about this, especially with all the public comment kind of brouhaha that happened, where people basically weren't heard in leading up to the decision?
Yes, I can. I think a lot of it, unfortunately, has been, there's been a lot of fear mongering in the media. Some of the corporate PR people are preaching gloom and doom. But the fact is, I think, honestly, what will happen is this will be like Y2K. It'll be kind of a yawner. Nothing will happen when everyone is preaching doom and gloom. And then eventually I predict that things are going to get better. As for the FCC comment process, I think people who are complaining about that don't understand how it's supposed to work. The FCC is what's called an independent expert agency. It means that the commissioners are supposed to be experts in their field, and they're supposed to make expert decisions. And the purpose of the comment process is not to take a vote. It's not a ballot box, which is a good thing because a lot of people tried to stuff the ballot box during this proceeding, and that certainly wasn't a good thing. What the FCC does is it opens up the docket to comments, and anyone can submit a comment. And the FCC is required to look at them all and to look at all of the unique ideas. But it's not taking a vote. It doesn't have to verify who made the comments and whether they were real, whether the names of them are fake or real. That doesn't matter because they're going to decide as experts anyway. They're looking for ideas. And once they've got those ideas in hand, they're required by the law to respond to any unique ideas that they see. And then they go ahead and they make the decision as experts. So I think that the process, it could have been better. It could have been easier to read all the comments if there weren't so many fake ones in there. But I don't think the fact that there were fake ones there is going to affect the result.
All right. Well, things don't turn out like Y2K and they go south. Can we hold your feet to the fire on that?
Feel free to do so.
Okay. Because I'm still holding out on this one. I'm not quite so optimistic, but I really appreciate your perspective and taking the time to join us. Brett Glass, Lariat.net. Is that right?
That's correct. Lariat.net.
Excellent. Thank you, Brett. We'll talk to you soon. Have a great night.
You too.
All right, and finally, 2017 has been quite the year for tech news, not to mention gaming news. 2017 had a good amount of our next guest in it while the show was happening daily as Tech News Today. Welcoming back to the show, the always awesome Sam Moscovich from Ars Technica. Are you? Have you just been playing that Switch the entire time?
Score, guys. I'm. You know, I've got a. You know, something about this Nintendo Switch. I just cannot stop playing it.
You've been playing it literally since the last time we had you on, right? Straight?
That's true. That's been, I want to say, 4 months that I've been playing Zelda Breath of the Wild nonstop. And now I'm finally coming up for air, even though it's a portable system. And I could really just take it with me wherever to talk to you about video games and VR and other interactive things in 2017.
Well, it's great to have you back, man. We thought we'd take some time to do a bit of an end of year roundup of some of the biggest, most notable gaming news from 2017. You're just the guy to do it. So first and foremost, the top of the list has to be what I would consider to be kind of a retribution story for Nintendo with the Switch. Would you agree?
Retribution? That's like they're taking out their foes and enemies. I mean, redemption. Equally.
Redemption. Yeah, maybe that's the better word. Although retribution
revival,
gives it a nice twist.
Resistance, regurgitation. One of those R words. But Nintendo really did make 2017 their year in a way that I don't think anyone predicted. Now, we've been talking about this concept of the Switch, which was the NX, for I can't even remember, at least a year, because Nintendo had made the Wii U and it bombed. And they needed to convince investors that they had a plan, even though they are the kind of company who's flush with cash and can kind of mess around as they see fit. But they came out and said the NX is going to be a big deal. And everyone else said, I don't know, what are you going to have this waggle the Wii again? What's going to happen? And what they came up with was essentially slamming together a lot of other things we already use. Bluetooth communication for wireless controllers, a portable, powerful device. But what they added was this home and go concept that essentially said, we are going to do something different as in a home system that can only be done in 2017, which is to slap a really powerful tablet with actual useful controllers that you can either hold by yourself or pull off and share with friends, either at home or on the go. The result has taken off and it was met with software. So what Nintendo did was it made a clever, powerful system that was very clear about it, what it could and couldn't do, and then just kept on pumping out software. We're so used to Nintendo saying they're going to come out with a bunch of stuff and then delaying it or taking forever. We're so used to every Christmas season hearing at the last minute, oh, that Mario or Zelda thing you've been waiting for, not going to happen. This is the first year in as long as I can remember as a games fan and writer that Nintendo did not last minute delay anything announced for a year. Everything they said was going to come out this year, including a giant weird RPG called Xenoblade Chronicles 2, came out when they said it would. And it's good. And other companies have joined up and said, we have games. So you can grab a Switch and play big games, small games, indie stuff, experimental, adult fare, kid-friendly fare. It's all there and it's distinct. So if you as a games person, whether you're a giant fan or just a casual observer, say, I want something with that Nintendo touch, the Switch delivered, which is good because they sure as heck couldn't produce enough of their other popular thing, the NES Classic and the Super Nintendo Classic. And if the Switch wasn't kicking butt, we would instead be complaining about how we don't have enough of these old retro replica systems. But they've actually brushed that under the rug with how well the Switch did. So great games, great hardware, good stuff.
So I originally made fun of the Switch because the marketing material in the beginning were people happily playing in a bar. And I was as surprised as, well, I was very surprised that it was so popular, but I don't see it out in the wild. Like, do you see, like, do you go out with friends and play the Switch?
We have a lot of rooftop parties where we're just all playing the Switch just like in those commercials. No, I do see, depending, I mean, I'm in Seattle, so people tend to stick their faces into screens. And I do see the Switch at the airport, on the bus, the train, out and about. It's not glued to people's faces the way smartphones are, but it's used, it's talked about, and I just hear good things. It's happening. Also, there's enough of them out. There's Fred Meyer is the big box chain near me, and you can go in and still pick up a Switch. Not a ton of them, but they're around. It's happening. They've sold over 10 million worldwide, which is really solid for a first year, especially for a company that loves to do these sort of fake shortages that Nintendo's done forever. So they're out there. They're happening. And there's, you know, Skyrim doesn't hurt as well. Whether you're playing a Zelda or a Skyrim, a lot of these big epic games mean you've got stuff that can take 40, 50, 60 hours to beat. So yeah, throw it on the bus.
Yeah. Take it to the basketball game and play a basketball game on the Switch and then play a basketball game in real life. That's how it's supposed to go, right? Now, I've been in the market for just very, you know, maybe a couple of weeks now. Sometime in 2018, going to be getting a new TV. We have a rear projection LCD 1080i TV from 2005.
Oh,
that's our living room TV.
Tragic.
Welcome to my world. I know.
That's almost as bad as net neutrality falling apart. Holy goodness.
It's depressing. But hey, I've got the green light. We're going to get a new TV next year, so I'm happy. Definitely noticed in my short time researching a high emphasis on 4K. Does the gaming quality or does the gaming content for 4K, like, is it plentiful at this point? Is it, I don't know, is it something that you can expect?
Yes, sorry, I just went into Smurf mode there, but really, 4K content is out there, which is impressive because what we're doing is we're putting out systems that require four times the pixels as a 1080p TV. That's no small thing when we're trying to render all these incredible effects, lighting, shadows, polygons up the wazoo, and we now have two affordable mainstream options to attach to your television, whether you want games or just entertainment. The Xbox One X is the better one of these in terms of sheer polygon pushing and pixel pushing power. If you want to fill out all the pixels on a 4K display, you will get better results with Xbox One X than with its rival, the PlayStation 4 Pro. Now, these are sort of strange systems because they both launched in the past 16, 17 months with this promise of current games will work great on your 4K set. Or if you don't have a 4K set, just stick with the older, cheaper systems and play fine around 1080p. Now, whether you're going to get that mileage or not really does depend on how close your eyes get to the screen. 4K does not have that wow factor necessarily the way that 1080p did when we got to that from some older screens. At a certain point, your eyes just can't perceive that much of a difference. Now, I actually pull my screen closer to me when I'm watching 4K films and playing certain 4K games, and I can definitely see the difference, especially when HDR is involved. I got to earlier this year test out Planet Earth 2 on the Xbox One S. Now, that's not a 4K gaming system, but it will do 4K streaming. And with 4K Blu-rays and an HDR and 4K TV, you've got a lot of letters and acronyms there, but the ultimate thing is that you've got lemurs that look like they're in your room. And how many people don't want to hang out with a lemur that way?
I've always wanted a lemur in my room.
And so we're getting to that point where 4K panels and lemurs are just coming down in price. So if you're already in the market for a new TV, whether you just want to take your living room set and move it into the bedroom, whatever case may be, you're not spending more for more pixels. And you can go and spend $300-$400 for that set-top box that does more. So gaming systems really do push that more because they're the kind that impress when you've got extra pixels and you're really caring about how quickly and rapidly and colorful and beautifully this stuff happens. That 4K can make the difference. It's not necessary, but it's there. And as a 4K set owner, I'm into it. And I'm glad it's there. And I'm glad the stuff, for the most part, works.
Let's talk about the good pixels, the good kinds of pixels that are driven by good games. And we'll talk about good games, and we'll talk a little bit about the not so good games, or some trends at least in that direction. We'll start with the good stuff. What are some of your favorites from throughout the year? I know a lot of these that we have on the list here that you sent us, you had talked on the show in the past. Now we're at the end of the year. What would you summarize are the best of the list?
I think this year, it was a lot of kind of not crazy or wild or, oh my goodness, it's going to be the most mind-blowing brand new kind of game ever, but just a lot of solid big games came out. Three of the big ones for me are all these sort of open world, run around, do whatever you want games. And those are Super Mario Odyssey, which is only for the Switch, Horizon Zero Dawn, which is only for PlayStation 4 and PlayStation 4 Pro, and Legend of Zelda Breath of the Wild, which is for the Switch and also the Wii U, if you still for any reason are playing with that. Those three all have in common your ability to jump in and get sucked into giant worlds that sort of say, okay, we've done open world a lot. We've done Grand Theft Auto. We've done Red Dead Redemption. We've done these giant runaround Skyrim-y sort of games. But how can we do them in ways that combine either plot or opportunity or puzzle solving in ways that really feel fresh and wonderful however you want to play? Horizon Zero Dawn will lock you on a couch with a really great plot and incredible robo-dinosaur battles. You'll feel like a hunter more than you'll feel like a warrior. You're really dealing with packs and strange animal mentality. It's just the kind of thing that only a video game can do because it creates that incredible tension and energy that you could only dream of in an action film. Super Mario Odyssey is more open world Super Mario, which we've been waiting for one of these for a while, gosh, since the GameCube era. And it's just great. And it really leans well into the Switch being a play whenever you want. You can have these little quick, you're going for moons. There are all these little moons around and you're just trying to collect them and Mario goes wahoo and all that. And you can do that on the go in these little quick bursts, or you can sit in the living room and lose yourself. And Zelda Breath of the Wild is somewhere in the middle. It's the kind of game where the world is open and it's very quiet and desolate. And the opportunity really is what you make. You see a thing and you think, in real life, I would set that on fire. You can do that in Zelda Breath of the Wild. There's all these little things where you go, in real life, I would do this, and you do it, and it works, and you get this opportunity to discover. They're all really cool in very different ways in that respect. Now, whenever you have me on, I'm much more likely to talk about small fry, indie, weird curios. But I got to say, in terms of surprising cultural zeitgeist things, PUBG, PlayerUnknown's Battlegrounds, is kind of the opposite of that. It is kind of bootstrap, small, and indie, but everyone's playing it. It's expanded rapidly. It just came out on Xbox One, and that version kind of stinks right now, so don't get that one. The computer version for Windows PCs is now, quote-unquote, 1.0. That doesn't mean it's done, but it does mean they've sort of reached this milestone of saying this core experience of landing as a helicopter drop-down, I'm sorry, airplane drop-down, and you're battling 99 other people and trying to survive. This is a very 2017 game. Requires powerful computers, internet connections, and giant worlds. The result are these sort of emerging storylines. In fact, many game designers I talk to have been very inspired. They look at this game and say, the plot is really about what people make it. You know, it's like an adult Minecraft where you jump into the sandbox and the stories aren't what has been pre-written, but what you and your friends sort of uncover beat to beat in these crazy battles. I love when games come together and make us as players become the storytellers. And PUBG, I think, is tops in that respect for doing that. And then the rest of my list is some weird stuff. Static is spelled S-T-A-T-I-K. That is the VR game of the year, and we may talk about VR some more. That's for PlayStation VR. It's incredibly clever puzzle game. I could go on and on about it, but you can head to ArsTechnica.com for a spoiler-free look at why I think it's worth going out and borrowing a friend's PlayStation VR and trying it out. There's Sonic Mania, which saw the old 2D Sega Genesis 90s Sonic style finally come back in a way that feels like those old games. Clever, smart, fast. You can have that sort of quick burst action that makes you feel like you're in the 90s, or you can really dig in and see these clever designs that have only come from people studying what's good about Sonic and finally recreating it. There's Tooth and Tail. This is one that gets looked over by a lot of people, but it is StarCraft that works with a controller, as in you just need a joystick and a couple of buttons, and you and up to three other friends can become little war commanders with all these crazy Eastern European rodents all doing battle. It's cute, it's approachable, it's deep. It really sunk its teeth into me. If you in any way like the idea of managing an army and getting into a battle, but also don't have time for these incredibly long, complicated StarCraft matches like maybe in the 90s when you were younger, Tooth and Tail, look it up. And last on my favorite personal list is a little puzzle game called Fidel, F-I-D-E-L. I believe it's only on computers right now. I hope it'll come to other systems and phones soon. It is just a quick game in which you manage a little dog around these puzzle worlds. It resembles a game that I really liked from a couple years ago, The Witness, in terms of these weird line puzzles. But it's constantly generating new random puzzles that always make you make tough decisions in order to keep going. That's really a short way of putting why I continue playing this game. It's been a full year. I play it pretty much a few times a week. I really dig it. Now, that's me just going on and on and on. And Ars Technica will have a full best 25 games as voted on by all of our editors coming up on Christmas Day. So you can log in for a lot more of our deep dives and conflicting opinions. Because if my other staffers were here, they'd mention perhaps some more giant RPGs, sports games, all kinds of weird stuff. There's been a lot of video games this year.
So, Sam, you also cover tech policy, and I noticed that you wrote a piece on the breaking news this afternoon that Eric Schmidt, chief executive at Google, is stepping down. He's now becoming a technical advisor. Any idea, like, what do you make of this news? I know we're all still digesting it, but what do you make of the news that he's stepping down?
Well, I mean, when you're dumping news on the Thursday before Christmas after the stock market closes, probably trying to get it somewhat buried. You're not going to announce this on a Monday when everyone is coming back to work and talking about it. It's a weird decision. We haven't really heard from Schmidt very much in the past couple of years publicly. I mean, really, it was really the last sort of headlines attached to him were testifying in the Oracle v. Google trials in 2016, and also his specific out and proud political contributions and statements about things like net neutrality and climate change. And I believe his donations to Hillary Clinton were no secret. I'm not sure that that is necessarily an obvious domino that attaching himself to politics had anything to do with him stepping down. But there is a statement about his work on philanthropy and science and technology advocacy, something to that effect. Definitely things about speaking out on policy with science and technology. So I wouldn't be shocked to see him just say, hey, in a more board, still part of the board, still part of Alphabet, but not in that high leadership role as a chairman, he's going to be able to go, okay, I'm ready. I've got my money. I've done my things at Google. Now to make, you know, the do no evil Google world, maybe for him, that means going full hog, 100% political advocacy for things that your prior guest talked about, for example.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's hard not to imagine that it has something. I mean, it's hard not to see that, for me anyway, to not see this as, wow, like Google, as well as Facebook, and to some extent Twitter, have really gotten, and definitely Amazon, have gotten themselves into some situations this year that are controversial. I would say especially Google with the YouTube kids, all the violent videos, and, you know, just their creators posting Nazi videos and advertising on all kinds of things. Like, it almost feels like, wow, like maybe he's just like, I created a monster. I'll be going now.
I mean, his last real departure in terms of leadership at Google was when he failed to, as CEO, really face off and address the fact that Facebook was happening. That was what he talked about when he stepped down in 2011 and handed the CEO role back over to Larry Page. I'm not sure that he is as connected to that leadership of, oh man, Google and I'm sorry, Alphabet has its, you know, hand in so many pies. And there's a lot of responsibility that I think major technology companies, especially as they outsource their work to average users, really need to do. I mean, 2018, I think, is going to be, and this is a, could be a much longer conversation, a year of reckoning for companies that expect us as users to do all of the heavy lifting when things go bad. I've actually quit Facebook and Twitter, except for announcing that I was going to be on today's episode of, you know, you guys' show. Mm-hmm. It's been amazing and wonderful, and I plan on writing about it soon, mostly because I've pulled it off. It's kind of amazing, and I think I'm a better human for it. I still, you know, log in and see what you guys are up to, but there's
good,
you know, the endless anything that does this that never stops to fill that insecure hole in my heart, I've sort of been pushing away. It's kind of awesome, and I encourage all of everyone to try not to do that as much during Christmas, whether it's with video games, friends, or a combination.
It's crazy when you do that, you realize there's a whole new world out there waiting for you. Mm-hmm. I would sing the song, but I'm not going to. Megan will, though. Before we let you go, real quick, what's the state of gaming going into 2018? You say that low-quality games are flooding the market. What does that lead to?
Yeah, if you go onto digital distribution platforms these days, there is such a flood of crapware. This has been the case on smartphone platforms for some time, and they've been dealing that for a while. And Steam has just, which is the biggest PC gaming marketplace, has kind of followed suit with, really, this is, again, letting the consumers do the brunt work of sorting. There's nobody at Steam really checking on stuff. And if you dig through the amount of racist, hateful, and kind of, I crap posting, I believe, is the nicer way of putting the kind of really dark content that gets snuck onto digital platforms, whether it's Twitter or game shops. It's quite a rabbit hole to go down. Anyone who looked at that YouTube Kids debacle, that's happening on Steam as well. So what I believe is going to happen is next year is going to be a bit of a reckoning for video games, because not everybody is going to be able to put games out like they did and expect to make money. Too many video games is just the four words I shout all the time. I'm going to have a week off between Christmas and New Year's, and just to try and catch up with games I didn't get to play. So I think there's going to be a flattening out, maybe not as bad as the 1983 crash of Atari et al., but there's a problem with quality control, too many games. The big dogs will still do fine. You're going to have Red Dead Redemption 2 come out, supposedly. VR is continuing to happen, even though it's been a niche. It hasn't died. And I think we may really see next generation 2.0 versions of hardware that combine better features, lower prices, fewer wires, some of that less complication to sort of segue us to what the VR, AR, mixed reality world will eventually be. I do think ultimately, using our hands and sort of virtual crap appearing in our vision is going to be the future of computing, but not with these things on our faces. It's going to be something else. So until we get there, I think next year is going to be the real hint of one, where the people with the money think it's going to go, and number two, how much the public rejects some of the dumber ideas. For example, Magic Leap. But that's a whole another conversation.
It's going to be weird.
But I think next year is going to be sort of the setting up point. I think everybody's been trying to set up dominoes and have content to see what will actually do well, be compelling, be talked about by average non-gamer Joes and Janes. It's you know, definitely keep an eye out in March. I think March is going to be more telling than January. CES is January, and we're going to see a bunch of crap. But I think March is where you're going to see, especially the Game Developers Conference, a lot of ideas begin to crystallize. So keep your calendars and clocks tuned to GDC in March of 2018 for a real clue of what to expect for the rest of the year.
Awesome. And we'll check back in with you around that time as well, because I'd love to hear, I think we'd both love to hear your thoughts on that when we know what the next generation is.
I'll just be doing this in the meantime.
All right. Good. Sam Moscovich from Ars Technica, it's really great getting you back on, man. Have a great holiday, and thank you. Appreciate it.
Happy holidays to all of you. And just a reminder to all of the tech nerds, the resistance lives on in terms of getting net neutrality back, the kind of thing that made a person like me able to have a career with an unfettered internet. I was able to create, write, and distribute things in the 90s as a teenage writer with hopes and dreams. We must all work together to fight and keep that stuff alive. You guys have a good holiday.
Fantastic. Thanks, Sam. What an outro. Bye, Sam. We'll talk to you soon.
And finally, this is the part of the show where we talk about the most ridiculous bit of tech news from the week. And I could not pick just one. So here's the first one's a quickie. Elon Musk accidentally tweeted out his phone number to all of his followers. What's worse is that he meant to send his phone number as a direct message to the CTO of Oculus, John Carmack, asking if he had a sec to talk. You got a sec to talk? had all of us scratching our heads about what he wanted to talk about. So hopefully we'll see that next year. And my final story is from the Next Web. They found a startup that wants to use your body heat to mine cryptocurrency. The Institute of Human Obsolescence, that's an outfit dedicated to finding uses for us meat bags when the robots take over, they've created a bodysuit that uses all your extra body heat to mine Bitcoin or other cryptocurrency. It uses thermoelectric generators to store the body heat and then convert it into electricity that you can use. And not why not use it to mine cryptocurrency? Because everybody loves money. There's a machine.
Oh, man.
At work.
This is scary. You want to know why? You want to know why this is scary?
I don't know. That's a nice suit. I like that. Why is it scary?
Because have you heard of LoPi? It was an Android malware that was discovered earlier this week.
Uh-huh.
And the malware on Android devices that were infected, not through the Play Store, by the way, but if your device was infected, among many other things, one of the components is that it would use your CPU cycles to mine for cryptocurrency. Uh-huh. And it would do so with such intensity, such processor stealing intensity, that within 48 hours, it could explode your phone. Don't do this, folks. You do not want to explode because your body is mining for cryptocurrency. That's all I'm going to say.
No,
you won't find me mining.
What else are you going to be doing? There'll be robots.
Well, I won't be exploding.
A robot will be sitting there. A robot will be sitting there. You will be a robot. You will be a robot.
You will not find me laying there mining for cryptocurrency. The last thing I want is a body that explodes. Okay, that's all I'm saying. Okay,
the Institute for Obsolescence is basically an art project, so no one's really developing this yet.
That's what they say. That's how they get you comfortable with the idea. I see what you're doing. Tech News Weekly records live every Thursday at 2:30 p.m. Pacific when there isn't a holiday, which is the case next week. So we have a little compilation, a little collection of some of our favorite interviews from throughout the entire year from Tech News Today and then Tech News Weekly. So we put together a couple of our favorites. And you'll have that to look forward to next week. And then the following week, we'll be back Thursdays, 2:30 p.m. Pacific, 5:30 p.m. Eastern. And if you want to be part of the show when we do return, email us, tnw@twit.tv.
And subscribe to the show so that you can just get them delivered right to you while you're laying there mining your body heat, harvesting your body heat.
I mean, if you have to harvest your body heat for Bitcoin, you might as well be listening to Tech News Weekly.
So. I would harvest my body heat to light my house so that, you know. I mean, why not? I have solar panels. Why aren't I walking around wearing that suit? That's what I'd like to know. Subscribe to our show, twit.tv/TNW. And if you want to tweet at me about where I can find one of those suits to mine my body heat, I'm at Megan Maroney.
Yeah, you need to do a review of the cryptocurrency mining body heat suit, whatever it's called. I'm at Jason Howell on Twitter. Thanks to Burke. Thanks to Alex. Thanks to Jammer B, who are helping out here in the studio today. And thanks to you each and every week for joining us for Tech News Weekly. We'll see y'all in a couple of weeks, but enjoy the best of next week. Bye.